Hello and welcome back to the North Pods Season 2, A Beginner's Guide to Obstetric Anesthetics. I'm one of your co-hosts, Owen, and this podcast is brought to you in association with the Royal College of Anaesthetists and the Obstetric Anaesthetics Association. Today, Rosie and I are delighted to be rejoined by Leila Gusketh, who you may remember from Season 1. She's a obstetric anaesthetic novice and also England netball captain. Together, we'll have a look at maternal physiology, and this podcast is in two parts. Part one is a systems-based approach of why things change, and part two is a bit more applied physiology as to what we're doing in anaesthetics. It's not everything that you will need to know, but hopefully it's a good introduction to some basic concepts. And also, we'll be answering some of those thoughts you'll be having around your first week of, why are they doing it like that? As ever, we've got some links in the bio, and we'll discuss those in the outro. So for now, I hope you enjoy the episode. In obstetric anaesthetics, one of the things that is actually turns out to be quite important is the mother and her physiology. And there's lots and lots of, I'm prepared to be cancelled over this intro, but there's lots and lots of changes that occur, and they actually directly and indirectly affect both your anaesthetic and the important bit, which is her overall health during the pregnancy, delivery and postpartum. And there's quite a lot of things to be aware of. And we've been very lucky to be joined by Leila Gusketh, who'll be leading us through. Hello, Leila.
Hello.
And welcome back to the NovPod.
Oh, thanks for having me back. It's great being here.
And just like the first season, Leila, you've just gone through your hashtag IACOA. Were you surprised by the amount of physiology that was different and you had to learn and its application? Or did it seem like something kind of naturally just came?
I was quite surprised, and I think it is really useful to know the physiology before or around when you start, because I know that I had a couple of pregnant patients on the CPOD list before I did OBS, and I don't think I had anywhere near the appreciation of all the changes in physiology. When I came to OBS and then knew a bit about the patients I was treating, I found it a lot easier to relate why we do certain things the anaesthetic. So I do think it is useful, and it's useful for exams, which is really boring, but very true.
Speaking of, this is the first time you've been back in the college.
Yeah, PTSD. Strong
PTSD. How you doing?
PTSD
feeling
vibes.
A bit tachycardic?
Felt very tachycardic. It's the way you have to walk up the stairs like multiple times throughout the day. So when I stood in front today, I thought, oh gosh, here we go again. But this is a much nicer environment, you know.
We can vibe you if you want.
It does feel a little bit like it. Two people just across the table staring at me. I mean, he's got his arms folded.
Yeah, exactly.
Quite aggressive.
Right.
Hopefully we can make today a bit of a nicer experience.
It can only be a nicer experience.
So what has been the best song that you've had on during a cesarean section?
It's not the best song, but I had an Adele playlist on for a lady who knew every single word and belted it out the whole way through her C-section.
Oh,
and I just
God.
Thought that was so impressive. And she also wasn't like English speaking, but knew all the Adele lyrics in English. And I thought, wow.
That is very impressive.
It was really impressive. Yeah.
It's probably a good demonstration of the changes in your FRC when you lie down as well, right?
It was great. I enjoyed it.
Did it help your spinal going in?
She didn't do it, thankfully, during the spinal. It was after. That would not have helped, I don't think.
No, definitely not.
So structure for this episode and learning outcomes would be for the listener, you, to come away with 2 to 3 points per system and then think about how we're and why we're applying that to the maternity patient in front of us. So we will aim for it to be a little bit concise and not covering the complete depth that you'll need to know in your ICAOAC or in your obstetric anaesthetics novice placement. But the main point being that we're introducing you into how and why things change. And we've divided it into a systems-based approach, and then we're going to go through a case. Where should we start on our physiological journey, Leila?
I think we start from A, don't we, Owen, like we always do.
So I'm told. So multiple ATLS and ALS and APLS courses have taught me that A does come first.
So Rosie, before I started OBS, everyone just said to me, pregnant moms, more difficult airway. And that was it over and over again.
That is the summary.
That is the summary, but why? What do we need to think about?
So I guess there are a number of things, but to summarise them, you have an airway which has a higher chance of mucosal edema and airway friability, which means that you might run into difficulty when you're managing that airway. For that reason, there is a completely separate DAS guideline for obstetrics, which we will link to the bottom of the episode, which plans for that difficulty and tells you what to do about it. You've got a larger amount of soft tissue, so you've potentially got some engorged breasts in the way when you're trying to do laryngoscopy if you're doing a GA, and you need to do an RSI because you've got a higher risk of regurgitation and aspiration of gastric contents down the airway. So you've got a whole number of things there that can make your airway management a bit more tricky.
I was quite interested to know, Reid, in your notes that Embrace recommends that you use a size 7 tube or below unless you've got a specific reason as well. Mm-hmm.
So you've potentially got a narrowed airway, so this should be a short procedure, right? There's no need to have a giant tube in there, and you don't want to end up in a situation where you've tried to intubate with a big tube and then you've got lots of airway swelling.
Do you have a look at the DAS algorithm, because there are some specific points that I don't want to say wasn't aware of, but was quite interested to see different changes. One is that they come up with a decision algorithm if you can't intubate, which is useful to know. Two is that you're only allowed to have 2 attempts as per the DAS algorithm, and you shouldn't be insufflating for ventilation above 20 centimetres of water, it recommends. But obviously, guidelines are there. You've got the patient in front of you, so do what you need to do. Any other thoughts that you had about airways when you've started off?
For a lot of the patients I've seen, our consultants reach for the video laryngoscope quite quickly, I think, for the reasons that you've just said. There may be more difficulty with the airway, so just optimising whatever you've got and the equipment available to you.
We're all nodding.
Yeah, in agreement.
I also think it's quite an interesting scenario to be in, because you've actually got a room of MDT people staring at you whilst you intubate and being aware of optimising your situational factors, and just know it's a little bit more pressure than you normally have when you're doing an RSI for a lap appendix.
Yeah, I think the human factors actually in it are probably more stressful than necessarily the physiological changes, because you're just trying to do it in a pressurised environment with a bit of compromise in B, which is what we're going to come on to next.
Ooh.
Segue, love it.
Baguettes, what are we doing for B?
Yeah, so over to breathing then. So Owen, what changes are important for us when we're thinking about the obstetric population and breathing changes?
So there's quite a few, but I think the ones we'll focus on is your apnea time goes down and your CO2 also goes down. So apnea time's a combination of the fact that the mother at term is using more oxygen anyway. By about 50 to 60%, don't quote me in an exam. One that you can quote me on is that your functional residual volume, your oxygen bank, goes down. So even if they're standing up, it's down by 20% by after, I think it's 32 weeks. And if they're lying down, it goes down to 30%. So you've got less FRC, you've got an increase in oxygen, that's less oxygen that is in the mother's system, which means she's going to desaturate quicker. So you need to pre-oxygenate well, you need to position well, and you need to be thinking about that when you're doing general anaesthetics. The next thing that we mentioned is that your carbon dioxide in the maternal blood is slightly lower. So progesterone, I think, makes you more sensitive to CO2, and as such, the minute ventilation increase. So people's tidal volume and respiratory rate will be higher by about 45%. That means that you should change your ventilation settings if you do a general anaesthetic to aim for that as well. It's normally, I've seen in one resource in eLearning for Health, 4.1-ish. Just know that you ventilate a bit more than you would do if you were dealing with a non-pregnant person. I think there's lots of other respiratory changes. Decreased apnea time, decreased PaCO2 is quite important. I know there was a paper in the 70s that quantified some of this as well, which showed that your oxygen, if you're measuring it in kilopascals, if you take healthy people, it goes from, in a minute, goes from 67 to 58. Whereas in pregnant people, it goes from 63 to 44, which is dropping about 20 versus the other one, which is a drop of about 9. So it's double the drop.
If you've ever been in theatre and heard that sats tone as they desaturate in the middle of a section. It's unpleasant.
I know that machine, they say that machines can't judge, but I feel that every time that machine starts desaturating, it feels like it's telling you off as well, right?
It does.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I've seen quite a few consultants, if it's heading anywhere towards a Cat 1, putting the oxygen on as soon as you can. So I guess that's trying to compensate for what you're saying, just trying to get as much oxygen in as possible before, knowing that your time is quite limited.
But we'll get onto that later.
We will. Sorry, I am moving on too soon.
But it's too advanced.
I know. Everyone tells me this. No, they don't at all. They really don't. Moving on to C. I learnt the hard way. Lying a pregnant lady at term flat on their back is a very bad idea. So what are the changes that we see in circulation?
These are quite pronounced. I feel like these are the ones that you will notice first when you're on the labour ward, hopefully. You can consider a pregnant woman as having what we call a hyperdynamic circulation. So there's an increase in cardiac output. There's an increase in stroke volume. These are all useful adaptations for pregnancy, but are things that we need to consider. We also find that, first of all, their blood pressure will reduce. That's because of peripheral vasodilation and a drop in your systemic vascular resistance, coming back up to sort of normal values at term. This is if you don't have any pathology.
So as your arterial blood pressure comes down, again, I think it's due to hormonal release, it stimulates your body to retain sodium and water. And eventually, over time, that leads you to have an increase in blood volume of about 40%, with only a 20% increase in your red blood cells. So you do get a dilution of anemia, but you do have a much higher circulating volume. And we'll talk later about major hemorrhage, but it means that people can cope a lot more with losing blood than you would do if it's a 90-year-old lady, for example, with you in recess with an upper GI bleed that I had last week, as you can tell.
As the uterus enlarges, which you've kindly mentioned, one of the things that we see with this is that if you lay a pregnant lady flat after kind of 16 to 20 weeks, you'll get aortic cable compression, essentially, and that will massively reduce venous return, lead to maternal hypotension and fetal compromise. And that can happen even if the woman isn't necessarily feeling unwell. So that's why we talk about things like a 15-degree tilt on the operating table, or if you're in a resus situation, manual uterine displacement, just to try and offload the weight of the uterus. Other cardiovascular changes, luckily, the peripheral vasodilatation works in our favour, and you will often find that it's much easier to put a cannula in for a pregnant lady than it is possibly in other places. But also, the cardiovascular changes can actually highlight cardiac disease. If you are somebody who actually has some underlying cardiac disease that hasn't been picked up, if you become pregnant and then your body tries to go through these adaptations, that's when you might find these women becoming symptomatic. So yes, it is normal to be slightly short of breath in pregnancy towards the later stages. But if somebody is exhibiting symptoms that concern you, obviously get that flagged up from a cardiac perspective.
Yeah, really important, because labour is quite a stressful event on the heart. Firstly, the pain causes a big sympathetic drive. And then also when the uterus contracts, the blood goes out of the uterus. So the woman gets a bolus of 500 mils of blood back into the system. So if you've got a heart that is at its limit, you could really start causing people to decompensate. And that's when you're going to start getting things like a failing left ventricle, which isn't great. So I hear. So the textbook sell me. The last thing that I don't think really gets spoken about that much is uterine blood flow. It doesn't auto-regulate, and its blood flow is arterial blood pressure minus venous blood pressure. So if the woman who's in front of you has got a lower than her normal systolic blood pressure, you're going to start compromising your fetal blood flow. And the important bit about that is that when I started training, I thought me being in the room as the anaesthetist was the most important thing there, right? It's not the case. It's the fetal monitoring is the most important thing. And that your epidural or your spinal, something that's going to interfere with the systolic blood pressure, it is paramount that you are monitoring that fetus throughout so that you can tell whether or not that is happy or it's coping well with that blood flow.
I was surprised at how much, it's like, what, 20% or something of the cardiac output of mom goes to the placenta and the uterus, which sounded like a huge amount to me. So
yeah, 700 mils a minute. Yeah, it's not an insignificant
amount. It's a lot, isn't it? So any compromise will affect it. Great, should we move on to D? Yeah. I'm looking at you, Owen.
Yeah, shall we start? So,
yes, Owen.
Were you surprised when you started as to how quickly spinals took when you put them in? It felt like magic, didn't it?
Yes, I was. And I was caught out by it a couple of times as well. When you take your time, swinging the legs around, and then you get to the top end, and then you realise the block's high, the heart rate's low, the blood pressure's low. Yeah, they're a lot quicker than I remembered on my 90-year-old trauma patients.
That's brought me on to two things here, right? So firstly, one is that your blocks will be quicker, and it's not just that you are a anaesthetist. It's that when you have got an increase in pressure due to the uterus, that causes an increased pressure on the vein system, right? And that will put backflow onto the epidural plexus, and then that leads to a little bit decrease in the CSF, but it does lead to an increase in pressure around where the CSF is. Your blocks have more pressure to shoot them upwards, so to speak. There is also some difference in pharmacokinetics and dynamics, which should just be aware of, is that your block works quicker. And I think it's also important to mention that during contractions, you will have an even bigger increase in that venous plexus. You could be at risk of hitting an epidural vein if you try and insert your spinal needle or your epidural needle during a contraction. And that's why we don't advise it, and we avoid it, so to speak, because you'll have to do some major back surgery in order to be able to compress in that vein. That's why your spinal can go up a lot faster than it would do, and it also means you use lower doses than you would do if we were doing hips and knees on a trauma list. The other thing is, I guess is more exam focused, is that your MAC goes down by about 30%, and your plasma cholinesterases also decrease as well. Although that doesn't really affect the dose time of succinylcholine, really, but it's a noteworthy thing to mention.
Yeah, I was going to say, does it change what you do?
No, no. Your liver enzymes, most of them work faster. They will metabolise drugs quicker. But in terms of what I do day to day, no. Am I going to decrease the MAC on my pregnant patient when I know that they have a higher instance of awareness? No, I'm not. But it's something that is written down in multiple articles, giving a bit of information so you can fodder it back to the examiners. Fantastic. I know there's a lot of science and a lot of facts in there, but hopefully there's a little bit of knowledge that will help with your practice moving forwards. What's after neuro, Lola?
Well, we've gone for renal, which I'm not sure is after neuro, but we're going to go for it anyway. A, B, C, D, R, G, H, F, K, whatever.
So, why did we do that in that order?
I'm not sure, but we've gone for it.
We've gone for it. Committed. We're committed to kidneys now.
Yeah. So what changes do we see with the kidneys, Rosie?
The main one for me that I notice in a pre-op assessment for a pregnant woman is that they should have a very, like, a high eGFR. Their glomerular filtration and everything is working in kind of overdrive. So I think this is one of the main things that I found when I was looking at bloods for women on the labour ward. They should have a low creatinine. And if they don't, that is abnormal. So a normal renal function in a pregnant lady is not normal. And I think that was one of the things that led me to then think, oh, hang on, is something else going on there? Is there some renal pathology here? Also, it's more common for them to lose glucose into the urine.
Lovely.
Yeah, great.
Can't think of a good kidney joke.
I'm not sure there's any good joke about the kidneys, to be honest.
You're in luck.
You're in.
Yeah. No, yeah. I get it. I just don't really get it. You've just said a phrase.
Yeah. You're just interrupting the flow.
Taking the piss.
Oh, that's the best one.
That one was actually
when
good.
It's organic, Owen, that's it. Trying too hard.
Comedy, so our bizarre alphabet, what have we done after?
After R obviously comes G. So gastro. This is an Owen alphabet if I've ever seen one. So gastro, Owen.
Well, there's two kidneys and one stomach, so I thought that would be more important to go. So gastro, there are a couple of things that are important to say. Firstly, gastric emptying isn't affected until the woman is in labour. And there's a reason in labour you've got pain, but they also receive quite a lot of opiates, and whether or not it's oral, IV or intrathecal, all opiates will slow gastric emptying anyway. Fasting times remain the same of 6 hours and 2, but I think it's after about the second trimester they advise that you do an RSI for all women, even if they're undergoing non-obstetric surgery. The other thing that's important to mention combined with that is that they have a decrease in their lower esophageal sphincter tone. And again, I'm going to blame that on progesterone. And that combined with increased pressure with gravid uterus results in increased reflux risk. And they'll mention quite a lot of Mendelssohn syndrome. And that's where, just to remind you of the FRCA primary knowledge that you hold in much greater
that
stock
disappeared
value.
Disappeared when I walked out of here a month ago. But yes.
Imagine how much it disappears five years later on. However, that is where gastric acid causes a chemical pneumonitis. And that has led to morbidity and mortality in our obstetric women. So it's important to think about. And that's how you can interact with H2 antagonists and PPIs to prevent that. Interestingly, it all goes back to normal by about 48 hours. So after 48 hours, you post-delivery, you don't routinely need to do RSIs unless there's an indication.
That's really quick, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, it is really
compared
quick.
Compared to other things that seem to last weeks, if not months.
Exactly, and it's something that I would therefore change my practice on based on a couple of papers that I've read. Gastric emptying and lower esophageal tone lead to more risk of reflux and aspiration. So take care and RSI with cricoid pressure.
And sodium citrate we often gave
really
to people.
Good point.
I know we'll get onto that later.
Do you know how long sodium citrate lasts for?
Well, is it 20 minutes or something really short?
Ding. I wish we had the prize, but no.
It's chocolate I would have taken. Anything.
Yeah, and fake promise of...
A mug.
Yeah,
a mug would have been nice.
There you go. Brilliant.
Yeah, so you just, as you're preparing, give the sodium citrate.
I remember walking in to my first Cat 1 GA section and being like, why are they doing this? And it is to increase the pH above 2.5 to reduce the risk of Mendelssohn syndrome. It's not that we have huge stocks and shares and giving people horrible tasting drinks before they go off to sleep.
Side safety note on this, make sure if you're giving someone sodium citrate, you are actually giving them sodium citrate and not acetone, which has been reported in the most recent Safe Anaesthesia Liaison Group newsletter.
Jesus Christ,
why
really?
Do we have bottles of acetone?
To remove nail varnish if you can't get a good SATS trace. So yeah, just be aware, be careful. Everything we do is laced with risk.
Oh dear.
Oh no. Oh. You can, like, when you read these case reports, you can see like what day someone's had.
Yeah, and you can see how it would happen and how it could happen to anyone.
And this is also the importance of a double check.
It's like a confirmation bias, isn't it? Like, you know, I'm going to look for evidence that supports what I think, and I'm going to ignore anything that doesn't support what I think I've just given you.
Right.
We've done G.
This does actually work. So we're going to go on to H. So we've already talked a bit about dilutional effects, but heme, what other changes do we see?
So there are quite a lot of hematological changes. Essentially, the woman is in a hypercoagulable state. Most of the clotting factors increase, the kind of natural anticoagulants like protein CNS decrease, and there's less fibrinolytic activity. And that is all a useful, usually, adaptation to try and facilitate clotting when the placental bed separates. But it does mean that there's a higher risk of venous thromboembolism in pregnancy, which is one of the leading causes of maternal morbidity and mortality. And so you might find that women who you are pre-assessing, depending on what their other risk factors are, may have been dosed with some low molecular weight heparin, which is important for the timing of your neuraxial interventions. Other things that happen, you can get a sort of dilutional reduction in the platelet count, and you can get abnormalities in platelet function as well, even if the number is normal. So again, your department will have guidelines based on platelet counts and whether or not it's okay for you to do regional. But you can see a reduction in platelets. And you can also get a high white cell count, and that can go up even further when the woman is in labour. And that can be a bit disconcerting sometimes when you're thinking about putting an epidural in. And there is a higher risk of things like peripartum sepsis. So you need to be looking at that white cell count and thinking, okay, does this number fit in with what's going on normally, or are there other things like the woman's febrile, for example? So those are the main hematological changes that we see. There is some pathology that can go on, which we'll talk about in the next episode, which makes things like...
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Woohoo! Makes things like point of care testing quite important in obstetrics, because bleeding can be a big problem and something that we encounter quite frequently, I'd say.
Yeah, I was surprised at how often the maternal hemorrhage buzzer goes when you're on OBS compared to on CPOD or other lists. Yeah. So yeah, I can see that.
One of the things to be aware of is that you will be given blood transfusions, and with that comes in that we do have different religions and different beliefs surrounding that. And one of those that comes up in both clinical and exam topics is Jehovah's Witnesses. In South London, have you treated many Jehovah's Witnesses in the maternity context?
Yeah, I have a couple. One who didn't really need anything, wasn't going for a C-section, and then one who did go for a C-section. It was elective, and so there was quite a lot of time to optimise and discuss. Cell Saver was ready. We discussed what she would and wouldn't have wanted, and luckily it was fine. It wasn't too complicated, but I can imagine it does get very tricky, especially when if blood products were needed and what people consent for. But in our hospital, we've got a Jehovah Witness person. I don't know what their official job title would be, but probably not that. But someone who offers good guidance and has those conversations as well, which is really helpful, I think, to just know what can be given.
And it's not as simple as will or won't receive blood products. Know that blood products can be broken down. Cell salvage may be acceptable if it's in one continuous infusion line with saline running through as it comes in. And it does mean that you should be having tailored conversations in, and then also speak to your department about how they want those documented as well. Yeah. It's just an important consideration.
And I guess things like TXA and whatever you can do to try and reduce blood loss intraoperatively with your anaesthetic and things are important.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Okay.
E.
Yeah.
Oh, my
Owen's
God.
Owen's magic alphabet, E. Made it to be chief registrar of anaesthetics, and here we are.
I guess I was going in order of importance. Maybe we should have had gastro above renal and heme above renal. Anyway.
No, I enjoy this. This is a good...
Keeping us on our toes.
Yeah. And there's not too much to say for this. Your thyroid disease in pregnancy increases, and there's specific management about thyrotoxicosis you need to be aware of. Know that's a high-risk person to deal with, and you should be talking to your consultant about that. And then also, as is probably intuitive, your insulin resistance also increases, and that's why you get gestational diabetes. And knowing diet versus insulin is very important, as you're not only controlling for the maternal blood sugar, you're also controlling for the fetal blood sugar as well.
Yeah, and I guess that impacts your management of someone's an insulin gestational diabetic, where they go on your elective list and that kind of thing, knowing a bit
exactly
more.
Exactly. I don't know if there's too much else, and all the anaesthetic obstetric endocrinologists will obviously be very upset at me saying this. I don't think there's anything more to say for endocrine.
No, you might encounter those patients a bit more because they might end up on your elective section list because of the complications of gestational diabetes.
Is there anything else to round up that was miscellaneous in our A, B, C, N, R, H, G, E?
In the Owen Dorr medical alphabet.
Fantastic, yeah, in the Owen Dorr medical alphabet.
I think it will come out in the next bits.
Oh, part
about.
Two.
Part two. Okay, so let's put that into practice. So, Layla, you're doing your obs on call. You've got to go and pre-assess someone. So I'm the consultant on, and I've said, oh, can you go and see the lady in room two? The midwife in charge has just come in and said that we need to bring her to theatre for a category two cesarean section. How are we going to approach the pre-op assessment of this person?
From what I've learned in my three-month block.
It's all you need.
Yeah. A lot of it seemed to be quite similar to kind of a standard anaesthetic assessment. Like, you would want to know why they're here, what the issue is, why it's a CAT 2 section, past medical history, anaesthetic history, etc., fasting, but also some more focused obstetric thing, knowing a bit about their obstetric history, past pregnancies. I always found it useful to know about previous types of anaesthetic they'd had, whether they had any feelings about any anaesthetics they'd had previously. I always thought when someone said I had an epidural, it didn't work, and they spent ages trying to get it, that you already knew that there was maybe some barrier or block or difficulty, which is helpful for planning. Drug history, a focus on low molecular heparin, when they last took that, because that would impact spinals. The other things like allergies, general anaesthetic history and risk, airway assessment. I think, as you said earlier, airways can be more difficult. I found that I didn't see anything that I found was very different with the obstetric population. So I almost, hearing everyone say it was a difficult airway, thought people would open their mouths and they'd all be mal and patty four and it would be really yeah. hard to see. But I guess you touched on some of the reasons why it's not necessarily what you see in the mouth, but it's all the other things, breast enlargement and mucosal friability.
Yeah, like more of an unanticipated difficult airway than a anticipated one,
anticipated,
right?
Yeah.
And then what about investigations? Did you look at any of that?
I had a look through bloods, and often, certainly with the elective sections, we'd have bloods from the last 24 hours, but making sure that they had bloods, platelets were really important for me. Renal function was important. Any examination findings, blood pressure, really important as well, or anything that was indicative of like preeclampsia or pregnancy-induced hypertension. And then I think Owen's very excited about the ultrasound findings. So I'll leave that to you.
Thank you very much. Also, good to see if they've got group and saves in date with no atypical antibodies. When we're thinking about the ultrasounds, I didn't appreciate this when I first started, and people say, well, about the ultrasound. It's like, oh no, I'll be able to get the veins in fine. Actually, all women have a ultrasound to look for their placenta and where it is, and that's because it has a huge effect on their bleeding risk. And there's two conditions that we'll go through in our pathophysiology podcast next, but there's previa and accreta. Previa is where the placenta is going towards the os, and it's got four different stages, and depending on how much it covers the os. And accreta is when it's starting to go through the uterus wall and beyond. Do have a look at that ultrasound report.
I think one of the things I found tricky sometimes about OBS pre-assessment was the environment. Like, not so much for the elective sections, because they're often like a bit more relaxed and excited. But I sometimes found it tricky going into people's rooms when they'd just been consented by the obstetric team and it wasn't really what they wanted. So then you're trying to kind of take a history from someone and talk to them about an anaesthetic while they're a bit distressed. And I found that a bit challenging. I don't know if either of you found that or there are any tips for that.
A couple of things. One, know who people are in the room and learn their names. Don't call people mum and dad. Secondly, use language line. Do not use family to translate.
Oh, yeah, that's a big one.
The third one is to just try and build a bit of rapport, which is easier said than done. But oh, I'm very excited. I'm pleased to be here. As you can tell by my hypotenuse voice, what we're having, what we're looking forward to. Oh, it's brilliant. Have you got any baby names? Have you heard that Owen's a great baby name? Still yet to have anyone name their baby Owen, oh, which is...
First time. I actually have had a baby named Rosanna, but it was the plan anyway. Yeah. So I just reinforced it. But at least I didn't put them off. Like that, they could have changed the name.
That's true. Yeah.
I think also remember that these people are probably going to remember you for the rest of their lives. And actually that's a really special thing. And even though you're going through and asking your normal questions, when someone's having contractions, don't relay anything that's needed for formal consent to them during those. And you also need to have in your back pocket, that's my final, how many tips am I wanting now?
Four? I don't know, like seven?
145. Have a Cat 1 history in your mind.
Yeah.
So an ample.
When you asked your question, the thing I was thinking first was the Cat 1 section.
It's horrible.
And just it really shocked
yeah.
me seeing the first one. And it's almost,
you're
as
walking
we're
down,
going
the,
down
corridor,
the corridor, you're trying
firing
to...
firing questions.
Yeah, and they're yeah. obviously terrified. Yeah. And there's so many people and so much chaos. But yeah. there are things that you want to and need to know yeah. to give a safe anaesthetic still.
I think for that one, your primary thing is, right, do no harm. Mm. Okay, so you can ask a series of quick fire questions that you need to know that will change your practice. And then just try and be as quick and as thorough as possible. Awesome. And it's really difficult. You know, do you have any medical conditions? Have you had an anaesthetic before? Did you have any problems? Do you take any meds? Have you injected anything to thin your blood? Yes, and a quick airway assessment. That's really, all. That's kind of all.
That's all you need to do, though, isn't it? You need to risk assess, can I GA this person safely? Can I tube them correctly? They last ate a burger an hour ago. They took low molecular weight heparin 4 hours ago. You're just going through a checklist to change your technique to make it the safest for mum.
Even if you've got a really well pregnant mother, a Cat 1 section, always helpful to have a second pair of hands. Yeah. I don't know about where you work. As the general reg, when the Cat 1 bleep goes off, I would always go anyway, just to see if they need some help, because there's just a lot to do very quickly. Calling for help is always, always a good idea, especially if you walk into a room and you've got somebody who looks like they're very high BMI and you're about to go for a Cat 1 section. Just get some backup.
Yeah, hands are helpful, aren't
yeah.
they? We've done the pre-op, and we're moving into theatre.
It's taken a long time.
It's taken a really long time.
But it's not a cat one. Yeah.
There's actually quite a lot going on, isn't there? You don't think, even in the elective setting, I found that once the spinal was in, there was quite a lot to even think about.
There's a lot going on.
And suddenly you turn around and they're hypotensive. So minimising anything that can cause delay.
Exactly. And I don't know, anything else, Owen, that you do to set up before you've even started?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. So first, communication with your teams. Where you're going and how quickly it needs to be, really important. Second is I continuously talk to my patients with what's going on and why we're doing it to make them more at ease. I've already done my prep, do it at the start of the day where I check the machines. I've got my emergency drug box, I know what's in it. And then know, especially when you're new to a department, where the difficult intubation stuff is and the pillows of Oxford. My one thing is I do not start unless I'm happy with a cannula that I would be happy putting 300 mils of blood through in a minute.
Yeah.
Do not work on a cannula that you're sort of, it's okay. Fetal heart rate monitoring, again, being the most important person in the room, I thought, why would I ever need to continuously monitor the fetus? Well, things do happen and they happen quickly and you are in a place where we've already said that the aortic cable compression can decrease your cardiac output by 20-30%. If you've got a trace where someone is, a fetus is demonstrating that they've got hypoxia, and then you're adding in 20% less cardiac output, they're going to get mild hypoxic. Your Cat 2 is going to become a Cat 1. And you need to have demonstrated that you've been able, second by second, monitored that fetus. I also would say that the other thing I do is, in the morning, make sure I've got fluid warmer. That's part of the setup for equipment and obstetrics.
I think what you said about just general prep in a new environment is really important as well, because I actually found OBS theatres, if you call them theatres, so different in the setup to CPOD and elective theatres. And I remember someone being hypertensive and trying to just even find where the phenylephrine was kept, like, ergonomically. So just, yeah, really orientating to the environment and where you find everything that you need, I think is a good important point that you said.
Lovely. And then you can set them up for the spinal, the phenyl, and that is because we are predicting cardiovascular instability post your spinal. So a couple of things. One is that you've switched the anaesthetic machine on, because that can be quite annoying.
If you're worried that your Cat 2 is more of a Cat 1.5, you can also pre-oxygenate them while you're trying to do the spinal. And then if your spinal fails or things deteriorate, you've already had a few minutes of good pre-oxygenation.
That can really help with your structure. If someone is saying Cat 1, we're going to reassess when they come in, get them over, put 15 degree tilt on, give them oxygen, and start, unless they've got PET or a cardiac contraindication, do just bolus of fluid.
And what you have just described is intrauterine resuscitation, which is recommended.
Do command the situation. Make sure you've optimised their position, because 9 times out of 10, when I get asked to come in to assist with the spinal, I do change the position, and not just to make me feel better.
A really senior good ODP seemed to correlate highly to the success of my spinals. I think it was everything you said, just helping with the positioning, tilting the bed, anything to just try and open the space seemed to really help.
In practice, I then get them to position the patient quickly with the aortic cable compression on and her neck flexed. There are recommendations for when you should start checking your block.
It's being mindful of the signs of a high spinal. Technically, if you've put the patient into a good position, given a normal dose, and you've injected it at a normal speed, and their neck is flexed, you shouldn't get a high spinal.
That's two important things, actually, to say about spinal. A, do not inject air into the CSF. And B, inject about a millisecond. Otherwise, if you try and bolus flush it, you're going to send it shooting straight up towards your T1 fibres. As the block starts to increase, it starts from, let's say, T10 upwards, it starts to cause sympathetic blockade, which causes vasodilation. They start to lose blood pressure to vasodilation. The block then starts rising until at T4 you start to get your cardiac accelerator fibres, and there will start being an element of bradycardia and a knocking off of that tachycardic response to hypovolemia. And your patients can really start reducing their cardiac output quite quickly.
I think this is a really important point to be really mindful about what's going on from a cardiovascular perspective and talking to the woman and being in close communication with her. Because if you've started to get a bit of hypotension and then you've given a bolus of phenylephrine, for example, and they then become bradycardic, you don't always know whether that's the phenylephrine bolus that you've given or if it's the spinal getting higher and causing bradycardia. So at that point, if she starts saying to you, I can't breathe, I feel dizzy, I feel weird, you've probably got a high spinal. It's trying to make sure that you're mindful of what you're giving, what the expected pharmacological effects of that drug might be, and how you can see whether it is or isn't one of those things, which is where ephedrine comes in. It's very helpful. That's going to increase the heart rate and the blood pressure. Some consultants that I know will give a little bolus of ephedrine if they start to get a bit of bradycardia, and repositioning is really important. So then you can go a bit head up and hopefully that spinal will start to come down a bit.
Is this sounding terrifying or is this useful?
This is useful. I was just thinking about how often you cycle the blood pressure during that when you're talking about how quickly it can happen. I guess you don't want to be having 5-minute intervals with your blood pressure monitoring.
You do need to be mindful. Part of the prep, right, that you've just saying to someone else who's got a non-sterile hand, can you just change the blood pressure to cycle every minute? Well, however worried you are, because you do want proper blood pressure monitoring when you're doing your spinal.
And this again is where the fetal monitoring is really important, because if you have got a reduced uterine blood flow because you're having a hypotension, you need to be correcting that, but you also then need to be considering what's the best thing for this patient if your spinal is not working. High spinals aren't black or white. Anything above T2 in my hospital is called high, and that's when you can start testing out the hands, right? So you've got elements of T1, C8, C7 nerves to test in terms of what you're doing with arm movement, finger flexion, etc. You can also explain to the woman she won't be able to cough as well, and that is normal because you've blocked off the fibres that correspond with the intercostal muscles as it has come out, and that if she needs some oxygen, you'll apply it, but you'll be with her throughout this whole thing, and if she's uncomfortable at any point, you can put her off to sleep. And it's really important to keep up that clear communication if you're heading above T2.
And speaking to your surgeons, I guess, as well, because if you're starting to change the positioning and things like that, it can make it a bit tricky for them as well. So just saying, look, I need to tilt this lady head up for a little bit. Is that okay?
And be very careful when you are that high at T2 that nothing's happening without your say-so. Someone pulling the legs up to get the catheter, what's going to happen with the legs? It's going to increase the pressure on your cerebral spinal fluid. That block's going to go up higher. So you need to have counteracted that by having your patient tilted up further.
I think when you're doing more and more OBS, as you start to get into a bit more of a pattern of bringing people into theatre and doing spinals and doing that sequence of events, it's really useful if you try and do things at set time points, because you'll start to notice a pattern of normal behaviour. And then if something happens, like, you know, 30 seconds after you put the spinal in, someone all of a sudden feels very dizzy and strange, that might make you think, oh, actually, that's quite abnormal to all of the ones I've done so far. So you'll start to recognise patterns of behaviour. And then when something's out of the ordinary, you can kind of pick it up a bit better. So trying to do things in a systematic way, removing your spinal needle, walking around, pressing start on the timer, talking to the patient, turning the phenyl up. If you do all of these things in a systematic manner, you'll start to get a feel for what normal is. And then when it's abnormal, something in the back of your mind, even if it's not necessarily conscious, might go, I'm a bit more worried here.
Do you have any questions about that? I think I've just rambled on for a long period of time. It
makes sense. With fluids, so you have your fluids connected, open, running.
Yep, I normally do.
Just when you go.
Advisos against that would be if there's a specific reason you wouldn't want to give fluids limited in conditions such as preeclampsia or
don't
come for us on Twitter saying, oh no, but you didn't say about PET. Like, yes, no, I didn't say Australia knowing about PET. This is for standard patient.
Okay, great. Moving on, so you've spoken about regional. Any considerations kind of regional versus general anaesthetic in this setting?
Yeah, I guess you've got to consider if you've done both that you might prepare yourself for some more hypotension.
Expect plus hypotension.
I guess you can put it back down to the systems-based approach, A, B, C. A, if I'm approaching for a GA, I know that there is an increased level of difficulty for obstetric women in comparison to people of their age, and they're an increased risk of reflux. I normally will only do it with a video laryngoscope, and after they've had citrate, thinking about their positioning, because I want to get it right first time, I know they're going to have a decreased apnea time with that reduced FRC and the increase in oxygen consumption. So make sure their position is perfect from the get-go. You need to control your environment and human factors. I'll often ask for silence in the operating room when I'm intubating. It sounds really douchey, but it's really important you are concentrating on the most important thing and you communicate really well with your surgeons. Top tip, do not anaesthetise a patient without the surgeon's present scrubs and ready to operate.
Tell the patient, if you're doing a GA section, I think sometimes they can get really panicky because people start doing stuff to them and touching them when they're not actually anaesthetised. So they'll start cleaning. Just say to the woman, they're going to start cleaning. We're going to put the drapes up. Please rest assured we are not starting until you are under a general anaesthetic. We want to minimise the amount of time that baby's exposed to the anaesthetic for. So we will get everything ready and then I will start. Like, just so that they don't think that you're just starting.
Yeah. It looks like a really terrifying time, and especially, yeah, you know, partners being whisked out the door, and yeah, it's all just such high stress that, yeah, yeah, I'm sure the reassurance is wanted and needed.
And I think the physiological changes are even more important here in the GA camp, because you really want to make sure that you've pre-oxygenated them properly, you've prepared for a difficult airway, all the positioning things that Owen's mentioned, and you're giving appropriate doses of induction agents to prevent things like awareness, which is much more common in obstetrics. And you're being mindful that you're giving a proper dose of paralysis to minimise your risk of difficult airway.
Avoiding opiates? Do you give opiates?
So it's an interesting one. Not traditionally part of an obstetric RSI, but some people will use them, especially if you've got a condition like preeclampsia, which we'll talk about in the next episode. You want
to use them
from a safety perspective. If you are using opiates, you just need to tell the neonatal team that you've used them, because they need to be aware that baby is going to come out very, very flat looking and might need some help with breathing. Kind of clinical controversies. It's not a classic RSI, but then I also personally use things like rocuronium, which aren't necessarily a classic RSI. What is done in your institution will be different kind of everywhere. It's my personal view, would be use something that you are comfortable with and that you know how to give safely.
Other things for RSI I would say would be just be well drills for when things aren't going well, and what you're going to do, who you're going to call, where's your backup coming from. So if you are taking someone that you've got concerns about, give someone a heads up. So either your senior reg who's around, or give your if you want to speak about it, your consultant, do so, so that you've got a plan in your mind for what you're going to do next. One of the changes to also speak about is that you are going to give likely an agent such as sevoflurane that causes a lot of further vasodilation, so they're going to get more hypertension, but also it causes a lot of uterine relaxation, especially around above 0.15 to 2 mAC. It can cause significant uterine relaxation that is resistant to oxytocin for tone and bleeding. Be prepared for bleeding with general anaesthetics. Brilliant.
Any other questions?
No, I think that's everything.
I mean, we've talked about haematological changes, and there are other drugs that you need to have prepped that will reduce bleeding, usually from uterine atony, which you want to make sure that you are familiar with. So those will all be part of your departmental policy. And things like tranexamic acid you've mentioned already. Mm-hmm. And if you're worried, knowing how to activate the maternal major hemorrhage protocol and what you get in those things in some hospitals when you activate that, doesn't actually do very much.
Yeah.
So yeah, being mindful of what you need to do to get blood into your theatre.
Yeah. And also the parameters are different, I learned, to a major hemorrhage in the non-obstetric population. So just knowing your thresholds are a bit lower and
definitely
important. One thing I really learned is to not just stay at the top end. Certainly in my first few sections,
circulate.
I just stood there obsessed with the pumps, but keep an eye on the board, keep an eye on the blood loss, because it seems to jump very quickly from 100 to 700 yeah. very quickly, and just yeah. being on top of that is something that experienced yeah. obstinatists seem to be really good at doing.
And I think like taking in the vibe of the room, so a very quiet obstetrician is also not necessarily the best sign. So you might want to have a little walk around the operating table at that point.
See why they're so quiet.
Yeah. Do you find it difficult, politely challenging? Do you find it quite difficult, the power dynamic between a CT2 anaesthetist and a consultant obstetrician when you're discussing those things?
Yeah, definitely. And I found something that was useful was asking questions more than, I guess it's that I've forgotten the stages of concern. Do you feel like you need anything more? Can I give you anything more? Would you like me to give TXA? Would you like me to give oxytocin? Do I need to put out a major hemorrhage core? And yeah. just asking questions that showed I was concerned to try and prompt it. I've thankfully never been in a situation where it's escalated beyond that. Yeah, I do think it is quite difficult. And as you've alluded to, there's a lot of task fixation sometimes, isn't there, with everyone in theatre. Someone getting quite quiet or not responding to your prompting is quite challenging.
I think that's also difficult when you've got an awake patient.
Yes.
Because you're trying to not be alarming, but also adequately raise your concerns. I definitely found that a bit challenging.
Okay, so today I think we've covered a wide array of areas, really, haven't we? I think we've achieved our learning outcome. So thank you for being part of this conversation, Layla.
Thank you, Layla.
Thanks for having me back. It's nice to be here.
Have you had a good time?
I have. I was saying earlier, I like that you're like growing with me. It feels like we're going through our journey together.
Yeah,
I've said I need you for, yeah, ST4 applications, please.
There we are.
I don't know what comes after that, to be honest, but I'm sure there's something else.
Neither do we. Yeah. We're currently on the programme. Lastly, are there any top tips that you would have for if you were speaking to Layla before she started on day one of her obstetrics journey?
I think I've found certainly the start just a really overwhelming experience from both a situational perspective, but just some of the technical aspects as well. My advice to myself would be to not be so overwhelmed by it. I'm not quite sure how to do that. But I think focusing in, I think it's actually quite a steep learning environment in terms of just the environment that you're in. So just trying to break it down into kind of the different objectives that I'm trying to achieve with each placement and each day that's there, rather than going in and being so overwhelmed by everything that's happening, thinking, okay, today I'd like to learn how to manage a elective cesarean section in yeah. that environment, and then try to build it all up instead of trying to feel like you have to know and do everything quite so quickly.
Fantastic. And thank you very much. We've enjoyed having you. And
thank you.
I promise to forgive you for taking the piss out of my alphabet.
No worries, Owen. Yeah. I'll get my mug in the post, I'm sure.
Yeah. In pieces. Yeah, all right, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Hello and welcome to the outro. I hope you've enjoyed that episode. I found it very informative going through it, and I did enjoy editing it. So, on to the links. We have the DAS maternity airway guidelines to have a look at, the DREAMY study, a picture of the correct spinal position, and we've also got the glass spine on YouTube to have a look at, along with others. One of the things that was mentioned was whether or not we use opiate during RSI. As a purist, it was discussed that you may not choose to use it, but the DREAMY study has shown that opiate use in obstetrics is increasing. And so I would discuss this with your clinical leads and also your consultants. Check to see what your local guideline does. Please do like and share this episode with your colleagues if you think it would be helpful. And we'll see you at the next one, which is discussing different techniques that we use on labour wards with an anaesthetic novice. Bye-bye for now.